Welcome to the new CNADHD podcast. I'm your host, Liz Lewis, and I don't want to produce another boring podcast.
My goal is to bring together the best experts and the best information about ADHD and to make it understandable and actionable. As you know, I am pretty much obsessed with the science of ADHD. So today's guest is right along those lines. Her name is Allison Arkfeld. She is a somatic psychotherapist. Her offices are in the San Francisco Bay Area. I first found Allison on Instagram and I started interacting with her because I liked her content, and I realized really quickly that she had a background in PTSD. And as I form my community and it grows and I work with people, I'm starting to notice that I have a lot of community members that have been diagnosed with ADHD, but they've also been diagnosed with PTSD. And so I wanted to sit down with Allison and ask her some questions about the interplay between the two disorders. With that, I give you Allison Arkfeld.
Well, I don't even know how I should introduce you. I have Allison, I want to say your name right, Allison Arkfeld?
Yes.
Okay, good. Yes. With me today, we met on Instagram, but then I just decided that she had the most interesting content, and so I had to contact her. And I looked up your bio, and I went to your website, and it says you are a somatic psychotherapist.
Yes.
So first, tell me what that means.
So somatic psychotherapist. So somatic is body-based. So I work with the body and I do psychotherapy with the body, mind, integrating it into trauma treatment, into anxiety, regulation, emotional regulation. Just, I believe in the wisdom of the body and that this is a vessel that can be used for healing. And so I specialized this last year in somatic psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm. That is really cool. Yeah. I just want to make sure I'm not, I feel like I read something about this. Isn't ADHD itself actually associated with a couple of different somatic, I'm going to use the word diseases, like sleep disturbances, mm-hmm. migraines, maybe I've read.
Migraines, celiac disease. Yeah, there's a lot of connection between somatic symptoms. And it used to not be known as much. It used to be like there's a somatic symptoms that were separate from the ADHD mind, right? And so they were separately attended to. And the newest research shows that kind of there is an interplay and they can't be ignored, and that the ADHD mind doesn't work by itself, that it works actually in concert with the body as well. So I find that very interesting. I think there's a long way to go in terms of application and what this can mean for people. But at least the research is starting to develop in that area. Yeah.
I think it is too, because I just read, actually it was probably on your website. There is an article out there about somatic disease and ADHD. And I swear it was on your website. I don't know.
You have an article up there on that. Yes. I think it came out in 2017.
Okay.
Yes.
So then, and you specialize in trauma and executive function disorder, which I giggle at because I have very poor executive function, like very poor.
Most people in America do, actually. Okay. Yeah, you're okay. I just want to normalize that a little bit. We're overwhelmed in our culture today.
What does it look like? Okay, so like the average patient, when they make an appointment with you, what does that look like? What are they coming in complaining about initially, or what do they want to talk about?
Well, initially, actually, it's more, it's either somebody who knows what the word somatic means and they're more holistic, and so they want to see somebody who specializes in a body-based approach to healing. So that's, you know, somebody who's maybe suffering from anxiety, depression, and wants to come see me for that. That's like the main, probably I'll get people from that arena. And then also people that have a history of trauma, and are looking for a trauma focused clinician, which is, 'cause honestly in grad school, where you're not specialized, we don't get specialized in trauma or ADHD. It's interesting. You think there's like an overview of it, but there's not really a specialization. So it's after grad school that you really specialize in one of these things. And so people who are are knowledgeable and want to seek out somebody who specifically deals with trauma and ADHD will find me. Yeah. And especially somebody who's been in talk therapy for a long time and wants to try an alternative method. I get a lot of people who've been in therapy or medication for, you know, a decade or plus, and things aren't working or their life isn't the way that they want it to look. And so, yeah, that's primarily, I don't know if that.
I was actually just thinking that more ADHDers and people with a trauma history should probably look into this type of therapy, because there, I mean, I hear, even in my support groups, I hear a lot of mostly women, but I hear a lot of people say, you know, I've been in therapy a long time.
Right.
I do like the best I can with the ADHD thing, but really nothing is any better or different than it ever has been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think talk therapy can only take you so far with trauma and with ADHD. And I think the body is, I mean, and it's the research has shown, like with ADHD, exercise, movement, all this stimulation with the body is going to actually decrease invasive symptoms or the anxiety that goes along with it. And also with trauma, it's become starting to become aware of the body and the signals that it's getting, can help somebody with trauma kind of come into themselves a little bit more, which ultimately I'm all about empowerment of self and of the individual. And so I think within the body that there's a lot of room to create that and to cultivate that with ADHD and actually with anything really, but it can be applied to ADHD. Definitely.
I feel like I run into a lot of people seeking something though, like something that they haven't been able to find yet. Exactly. In their therapy. Yeah. And
yeah. Cause yeah. People, I mean, you know, you talk about your childhood, you talk about your parents and you talk about the crappy things that happened and you get an understanding, you have insight around that, but you're all that's working on is a certain part of your brain that's just up in your mind. That is, so yes, yeah, awareness, this is the statement that my mentors told me, awareness precedes choice. So in order to really have choice over kind of the trajectory of your life, bringing awareness into that is excellent. But like you said, like for a lot of people, it only goes so far. And you can have all this knowledge, psychodynamic knowledge about your history. But really, what is it doing? Especially somebody with ADHD, that's not really going to fix anything. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be information, right? So.
And we just had this conversation last night in one of my support groups. We were talking about the idea of behavioral inhibition and the ability to even take the pause.
Yeah.
And I think with ADHD, that crucial pause to maybe come into the body,
like, right,
going on with me right now. I'm sweating. Like, obviously something's happening. I don't know that for all of us. Well, I know. I know for a lot of us, that is not a natural thing. And I use the words behavioral inhibition because that's, I was reading about it. You know, that's yeah. Why. but I feel like that's like a missing puzzle piece for us.
I think it is. I would have to totally agree with you. And I think it's pervasive amongst, I mean, our culture doesn't promote body awareness, body sensation, especially as women, we're taught to kind of like mold ourselves into some being that's kind of shut off from the body, but attuned to the body, but externally based on other people, right? There's all this stuff that we're taught. And we're not taught the language of sensation. Of like, oh, my hands are sweaty. What does this mean? Like the sensation comes before feeling. So getting in touch with body sensations and how you're feeling can bring you into the body and kind of settle the mind. And I think it goes along with mindfulness. And you know, like mindfulness with ADHD is wonderful. Yeah. It attends to neuroplasticity. I mean, over time you can come off medication if you're engaged in mindfulness practices, and that research has definitely been shown, you know, over the last, especially the last like 5 years.
So when okay. You emailed me, you yes. Emailed me and asked me what I thought. Well, first you asked me how I would coach someone
Yeah.
With a serious trauma history. It kind of, that makes me giggle too, because I don't consider myself a coach, but people use that a lot. And when they make the graphic for the podcast, I think it says Coach Liz Lewis. I didn't even make that. I don't know.
Gotcha.
But, I do have people in my community that I know have been diagnosed with PTSD. And I actually was talking to one of them just a few weeks ago. And I said, I feel like I don't know how to support you all the time. And she said, well, I have a therapist. I see my therapist twice a month. She said, you're just my soft place to land, you know, a couple times a week. And I was like, okay. And she's like, I don't need you to do anything other than what you do. And I was like, okay. Now, I will say that I have had times in the last couple of years where I meet someone who obviously, I mean, yes, they have ADHD, but there are other things going on. And you know, it does not travel alone. And I am very quick to admit and say, this is not my wheelhouse. Like, I can give you lots and lots of links and places to look for support and help. I'm not kicking anyone out of the group, but this is not something that I can do for you here in this group. So that's my answer to your question.
Gotcha.
I would just say, I have no problem admitting when it is outside of my comfort zone or my knowledge base or anything. So I just will refer out, or I'll even recommend coaches. If I feel like a person is ready and willing to invest in a coach, like I'll recommend other coaches. So
I think it's so important that to identify that how complex it can be for individuals, and that they need multiple avenues of support. And so like your client who said, I come to you for my soft landing, like that's excellent. She has a therapist that she has you, hopefully, you know, she has other avenues and communities that she engages in. I think that's critical, but it's really complex dealing with, like my question is always, cause with PTSD and ADHD, it's not, for me, it's not an or thing. It can be an and both. And so clinically, I'm always wondering, should I be coaching or do I go into therapy? And it's a hard line, because it's, I wanted your take on kind of how, when someone comes in and they have a severe trauma history, so say they're even getting help for their trauma, and so you're just doing your thing, but is there some way that you coach that's different with them that you find, or do you notice anything?
The individual, I'm thinking of two specific, the people that I'm thinking of, I have allowed them to message me privately, because there's a lot of times that if there are, I don't usually have a ton of people, but every so often there might be a meeting where there's like 10 or a bunch of us. And I have to play more of a moderator role when there's that many people involved. Okay. And, I know that some of my people with trauma history, it's hard, especially with new people. I've caught on to when we have a new influx of members, my girls with PTSD get really like,
yeah,
with new people. They're very threatened by new people. And sometimes they're a little possessive of me and my attention. Mm-hmm. Because they're used to having me to themselves, sort of.
It sounds like.
Yeah. So what I've done, and I only have two of them, like I said, that I'm thinking of, I will give them my cell phone, or I'll let them message me. And that seems to work for them when they're having issues with new people coming into the group, or there's too much going on in the group, or it's a conversation they're not comfortable with. They will just message me privately. And that seems to take care of it.
Love that. Yeah. That promotes connection, because they're already trusting you and feeling like they can connect with you. And so it promotes more of that to.
Yeah. Kind of so, I mean, that's not a great answer to your question, but.
No, it is. I think it is. I'm just interested, because I'm, you know, I come from the clinical world. And so I'm always curious, and that's, I mean, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Anything that promotes connection, especially for trauma survivors, is a really big deal.
And I think, with ADHD, we have a tendency to say, join a support group, or even worse, like a Facebook group or something, and think that that's going to be the fix it. Like, oh, Band-Aid, like I joined a group, and you can't have all your needs met through like one place. Like it's not going to happen. So I think being really clear on that with people and telling them, like, I think this is something you need to take to your doctor.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
which is really, really important. And to know that, like, you can have multiple angles of support, like I did, like we said earlier, and that that's okay. And actually that should be the norm, I think. And I don't think that it is the norm right now. I think that there are clinicians and doctors who specialize in ADHD and clinicians and doctors who specialize in PTSD, and they see through that lens, and it's a lack of research, I think, but also whoever you're going to is going to see through their particular lens and think that a certain outcome is best. And when it's an individual is, like, as a human, humans are amazing. I think we're mystical creatures, and we're, you know, especially with ADHD and PTSD, there's this creativity, this intuitive nature about people that's complex. And that needs to be attended to in its complexity instead of it being a singular thing of, like, okay, yeah, just join a group, get on medication, you're good. Or just go do EMDR for 10 weeks and you'll be healed. Like, that's, it's very, I think it undermines the human experience.
Mm-hmm.
In some way.
That seems to be how it goes, though. I get that a lot.
Yeah, it is.
I don't know. Or they get diagnosed and they give them a bunch of brochures. I mean, I've had people tell me that they got, like, brochure pamphlets. Oh, you have ADHD. Here's all the literature.
Right.
You just want to ask your family doctor for some medication.
Right. Yeah. Well, because exactly. That's what spurred me into creating this website and to this research endeavor that I went on, because I saw that. I saw that happening you know, people who know their stuff. And I saw it just being very singularly focused and separated out. And I don't know, it can be really dangerous in terms of somebody who has PTSD and the symptoms are overlapping. I mean, you start, like, what is it? Zoning out. It's like, you know, hyperactivity, zoning out, lacking of focus, like challenges with relationships, acting impulsively, hyperactivity. I mean, those are overlapping symptoms of ADHD and PTSD. If you go to a doctor or a physician or a clinician who's diagnosing, and they see those symptoms and they come from more of a specialization in ADHD, you're more likely to be diagnosed with ADHD and be put on a stimulant medication that may actually spur more traumatic responses, and your nervous system may go into more of a trauma response, which can be really dangerous for a trauma survivor. And so I just think there needs to be a little more sensitivity around that in the field.
Yeah. That's the perfect, talk about a segue. That was perfect. So let's talk about this nervous system. This, I wrote it down, polyvagal theory.
Yes. My favorite. So Dr. Stephen Porges came out with this theory. I want to say 2014, but it may have been a little before that. But it used to be that the nervous system was thought of as in just fight or flight, right? There was a parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system, and they were kind of co-regulating each other. And Dr. Porges came out with polyvagal theory, where he did all this research and found out that it's not so simple, and that there's actually the polyvagal nerve, which regulates, and it regulates through social connection, various ways. And that there's actually a hierarchy to the stress response. Mm-hmm. So someone's going to look for safety and connection first. If they don't receive that, they're going to fall into a fight or flight response. So they're going to, you know, they're going to try to run away or they're going to fight. And if that's not available to the person, then they're going to just go into shutdown in the dorsal vagal, which is just complete disassociation, cut off from their experience. And it's really on, like, a ladder in that way. And so, you know, if a person can then move up the ladder through social connection, through that regular, the polyvagal nerve, they can come back into a place of safety and connection where their emotions and their nervous system can begin to regulate again. So I think that's important. And I mean, definitely important in PTSD and trauma, but also with ADHD, and because the nervous system's interacting with executive functioning and everything. So.
Well, and I feel like in ADHD circles, a lot of the stuff I read, they talk an awful lot about fight or flight. They'll talk about fight or flight. They'll even talk about the amygdala.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically. Yeah. And I do, there's a part of me that when I read things, like I'll say, yeah, I identify with that, that feeling of always being on edge, like always waiting for the other shoe to drop. Like I can identify with that. I'm trying to figure out, like I said, with my, some of my group members, you know, if you have a trauma history, I'm wondering if they are even more so this hypervigilant sort of state, almost like in the middle of the hierarchy all the time.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. And, yeah. And it's, I think it's interesting too with ADHD, it's they're there all the time and it's almost stimulating to be there. Right. So it's almost this feedback loop of like, well, it's kind of rewarding to be here because
and they create it in them. They do it intentionally sometimes.
Right. Because it's, you know, I mean, the system's amazing, right? The system is trying to regulate itself all the time. And so with ADHD, it's that stimulation that's needed to kind of regulate yourself on some level. And mm-hmm. so being in that zone, it's a really interesting point. I hadn't thought of that, but that makes a lot of sense in terms of just kind of needing that. From that perspective. And then, but if, you know, with the trauma history, kind of just being in that zone all the time, like the quality of life that comes out of that, you know, that's where my heart goes out to individuals and people is how to move from that zone into a place of safety. So you don't have to be living in a state of intense stress all the time, right?
Yeah.
It's a lot.
And I know that there is some, he was actually on this podcast. There is some talk and research around, do you know James Ochoa?
It sounds so familiar.
He wrote the, Focused Forward. Oh, here it is. I have it. Focus Forward.
Oh yes. Uh-huh. Adult ADHD. Uh-huh. Ochoa.
he doesn't refer to it as PTSD, but he talks about the sort of underlying emotional distress syndrome. He calls it EDS. Of living with ADHD and how it presents a lot like PTSD.
Right. And then exactly. So there's the flip side of it as well, right? So it presents as PTSD sort of, it's this hypervigilance. Like you talked a lot on one of your podcasts about that need for control. So you'll see that with just trauma clients too, this perfectionism, but it's also, I see it a lot with ADHD. And so if you are going to get treatment just for trauma, but really you have this ADHD mind as well. Like it's just so delicate. It's hard to kind of know how to attend to it. Right. And so, and the most efficient way to attend to it. And I think a lot of people end up not getting the help that they need because they go 10 years kind of just trying to piece things together and, never really working out.
Well, I read one of the articles, again, probably on your, I'm 99% sure it was on your website, about this this nerve stimulation. Mm-hmm. Now, the article I read was talking about for pain, like I guess long-term pain.
Yeah.
What implications does that have? Because I wrote down a whole bunch of notes about the vagus nerve that I don't actually understand. But
it's complicated.
Yeah. Like, well, I get it, but yet I don't get it. Like, I don't understand how we would use this knowledge of the polyvagal theory to better or more effectively counsel, coach, and treat people with ADHD that probably have some level of trauma in their background. I'm trying to figure out, like, how do we explain it in a way that the listeners understand, like...
Gotcha. So what's coming to me is, I mean, polyvagal theory, all basically what it's saying is that connection heals. connection, healed. Okay. And so creating community, right? That's why go to an ADHD support group, be around people. You have set up communities that in a way is stimulating the vagus nerve because you're promoting connection and social engagement. Okay. And so in a sense that regulates the nervous system. So that's one form of how it can be kind of applied. On a more general level. And I think there's so much room. I mean, this is such a new theory. It's newly applied in the field of trauma. So I think that a lot of its implications are kind of unknown right now. Although I see with clients that I see with ADHD, they typically have a history of trauma as well, to varying degrees. The ability to connect, to really connect, can be calming. Somebody with ADHD, and to learn how to connect, right? Because sometimes I find a lot of people with ADHD, they're really empathic, like highly intuitive and empathic. And then also sometimes can just kind of shut that down because it's too overwhelming and they're kind of cut off and don't pick up on social cues and stuff like that. And that in that instance, I think this is just kind of a hypothesis coming to me right now, or a theory, that they're not in that place of social engagement in terms of the hierarchy of the nervous system, that at that point they're more in fight or flight and not really picking up on social cues and how to engage, maybe because they're not feeling safe, maybe because their brain isn't stimulated enough to feel safe, to be able to go and connect and be that empathic, intuitive individual that they really are, but maybe in a certain circumstance feel too overwhelmed and just, you know, can get kind of cut off from what's really happening and just kind of spinning out.
Actually, it made me think of, I always explain to people that when I remember to take my Concerta, I am much more able to articulate my thoughts and hear and, you know, connect with other people, and I have less anxiety, like social anxiety, when I take the Concerta. And then when it starts, like this happened to me at the conference in November, because that's a very anxiety inducing environment for me at the conference. I remember I told Terry over dinner, I was like, I'm okay during the day. I said, but at night, I don't feel like I can walk up to people and introduce myself and have any kind of meaningful conversation. I just can't do it anymore. And I'm much more likely to just be so full of anxiety that I can't even like, and that makes a lot of sense because when I'm on the medication, right, I'm not going to be as quick to jump into that like panic state.
Right. Cause your dopamine levels are higher, right?
Right.
So you're exactly. So there's kind of this, because of the medication, how it acts on the brain, it regulates the nervous system. And so then you're more able to engage, like feel like there's a sense of safety around you.
Yeah.
Engage. Totally.
That makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know much about that. What do they call it? The dorsal vagal, the shutdown and the disassociative aspect of PTSD. Do we even see that with ADHD?
That's a really good question. I mean, I see it with severe PTSD. And with ADHD, you know, what's interesting is I think ADHD kind of acts as a resilient force to go into that shutdown because of the need for stimulation. Mm-hmm. So I've never, with just ADHD, I've never seen the complete shutdown. Although that doesn't mean it happened. That's my clinical experience, but.
Although almost nobody with ADHD just has ADHD, you know?
Right.
I'm trying to think, like, I feel like there's a different type of shutdown that happens with ADHD. There's like the I don't want to call it voluntary, but I feel like we will, after enough, I'm going to say kicks, you know, after you've been kicked enough times, there is an element of, well, I'm just not even going to, like, I'm just not even going to bother. Right. Like, I've lost 10 jobs or something, and I'm just going to be unemployed for the rest of my life. Like, I'm just going to, like, sit here and that, I guess that's a form of shutting down.
It is. It's, you know, we call it apathy, like moving into this apathetic position of just kind of, mm-hmm. it's not worth it. And actually that is very much like, if you think, because I play legal theory, I really think of in terms of trauma, and I see it in terms of severe dissociation usually, or someone literally looks dead. And so it's a very extreme response. Kind of that's how I typically go to seeing it. But the way you're describing it right now, it's very similar. It's like, why it's not worth engaging. It's not worth being in life for, right? In a way, because it hasn't worked for me. I fought, and nothing's working. So basically screw it, right? I'm just not going to do anything. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I haven't thought of that.
And I think that, well, and I'm sure you're aware, with ADHD, we are at much higher risk for substance abuse issues. So I think sometimes if you get to that place, that's when, if you have a need for stimulation, you may, at that point, that may be when the substances come into play.
Definitely.
I'm totally throwing around theories, like,
the top. No, it's great. I work in substance abuse, so I am very familiar, and I find it's really hard. Gabor Mate, I don't know if you know it, this doctor out of Canada, who's just amazing, has brought a lot of awareness into trauma and actually ADHD. He talks about people with substance use disorders, and he says, I'm paraphrasing him, I think, but that not every traumatized person becomes an addict, but every addict was a traumatized person. And I think that, yes. And I will say that after working in the field and being around the field for over probably 11, 12 years now, that I believe that 100%, that I have never seen somebody come in without some kind of trauma history. It doesn't have to be a severe trauma history. It could be just that, you know, that the parents didn't attune to them when they were a child. I mean, that's trauma. That can be traumatizing. That can really affect your sense of who you are. And then that can lend to lower dopamine levels, which people, especially with like adult ADHD that don't get diagnosed as children, right? That learn how to compensate as children and then get diagnosed as adults. They have this history of trauma. They're getting diagnosed with ADHD as an adult, and substances have worked for them for a very long time to kind of cope with what they're feeling, to try to be okay within their own body, within themselves. And totally makes a lot of sense. It all kind of intertwines.
I actually told someone once that that I could not work with them because they drank so much.
Yeah.
Because I was like, this is not something for me. I was like, you're, you know, taking whatever they were taking during the day, and then you're drinking at night. And I said, I'm not a therapist, and I definitely am not like into addiction. I said, so you need to get other professional help.
Yeah.
Like, an ADHD coach is not going to do it for you.
Yeah.
I was like, you need to get more professional help. And luckily the person took it really well, but I wasn't about to take money from somebody like, yeah, with that kind of issue happening. Actually, you know what? We should probably define, not strictly define, but trauma isn't always what people think it is either. Like you were saying.
That's a very good point. Yes. So trauma is defined in the simplest way. Peter Levine defines it as too much too soon. And so this can apply to a variety of different areas. It could be childhood trauma. So having to deal with parents fighting when you're really young and it being too much too soon, or it could be that you're left alone and to fend for yourself and you don't know how to do it. So you have all these adult tasks as a little child and it's too much too soon. And it could be as extreme as sexual abuse, right? Rape, incest, it could be physical abuse, like all those factors are all trauma. I mean, it's all trauma. And it's all happening. There's too much happening too soon to the individual. And, so there's psychological trauma, there's physical trauma, there's sexual trauma, and psychological trauma I usually connect with childhood developmental trauma. So that's kind of how I don't know if that all made sense.
Well, and I think, I don't know if anybody, no, it makes total sense.
Okay.
I don't think anybody, I mean, I know very few people, maybe my husband, but other than him, I know very few people that had perfect childhoods.
Yeah, it doesn't exist. I don't think perfection exists in this world, especially, you know, as children, our parents do the best they can with what they have. And sometimes it's not enough for the child, right? And a perfect childhood doesn't exist. And the factor that really contributes to someone acquiring resiliency is having a parent that is, Donald Winnicott, this attachment theorist would be having a good enough, quote unquote, parent, somebody that can attend to your needs enough, right? They're going to fail. But if you can know that they're going to come back and attend to you at some point, that can usually add resiliency and you'll be like, okay, the world is safe. I can deal with things. I'm going to be okay. You know, but there's a lot of kids and individuals that didn't have that. And so they learn, oh, the world is not safe, or I can't trust people. I can't have my emotions because they're not validated by my mom and dad, the people that are taking care of me, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's, you know, so if you have a good enough parent, and I say this to parents all the time, like, you just got to be good enough. You're not going to be perfect, but you try, you know, and.
Yeah. I'm so glad you brought up attachment, because I don't know what it was, but I have an article on my website about my personal theories about attachment and ADHD. Because just based on conversations in my group about our families and our personal histories, we all seem to have weird attachment issues. And I don't know if it's a product of parents trying to raise ADHD kids.
Or the other way around.
Right. Yeah. Or like, well, and if your child has ADHD, that's probably, you know, there's a good chance you or your spouse does anyway. So,
right.
I have all these in my head. I'm always thinking about like attachment stuff and even my own issues in my marriage and that kind of stuff. But what do you think somebody should do? This is going to sound crazy. What should one do if one feels that perhaps they might have some trauma issues or attachment issues and they already know they have ADHD? Like, should they explore that?
Yeah, I mean, what was that?
What does help with the ADHD stuff?
Yeah, I think exploration, I think a relational exploration can be key. And actually, in somatic-based approaches that attend to the relationship, which is rare. You're not going to find a lot of people who do that. I was trained by somebody the relationship is what heals. So I think exploring that, I mean, I think it can be, yes. Basically, hold on a second. My answer to your question is yes. I think it's totally worthy of exploring. And I think it can lend to a lot of information and healing. And I don't necessarily think it needs to be all okay, let me go in and figure out all my attachment style and where it came from. And I think having an awareness around kind of what your attachment style is, if you're insecure, anxious, are you avoidant? Are you a little bit of both? Like, that can help you to understand how you're in relationship with other people and how you respond. But I think the real healing comes through a corrective experience, and that corrective experience being relational. So with somebody else, whether it be a therapist, whether it be somebody who you look up to, a mentor, a friend, it could be your partner. I see a lot of people who are healed just, you know, So say you grow up with ADHD, your kid with ADHD, your parents are constantly dismissing you and telling you to shut up and you're misbehaving. And you're, you know, as you grow up thinking something's wrong with me and that what you have to say may not be valid. And then you get in a relationship when you're an adult with somebody who just loves you and validates you and loves your brilliant creativity and the way that you look at the world and can give you that corrective experience that you kind of missed, I think can be extremely healing. Not that the relationship can be everything, but there's elements of intimate relationships that really can, I think by exploring it in a relational sense, you can heal a lot. Yeah. And you can do that through somatic approaches. That's what I found to be the most amazing is just this resonance and presence of somebody who can see you and validate you in a deep, deep way, like your parents should, right? But maybe they weren't capable of at the time.
The way you put that is so, for me, like so powerful because it made me think of my relationship with my husband. Because my parents, there's a whole history here, but my parents are very invalidating.
Yeah.
But get this, my husband has so much more like, I'm going to say faith in me and like so much more like, he's just like, oh, well, you can do that. Like he thinks nothing of it. Like he's just like, and he's not, I'm not gonna, he doesn't like smother me with it. Like he's not like that, but it's just interesting that I married somebody who is so much more validating than like anything I grew up with.
It's like you knew what you needed. So you know, that's amazing. So how has he helped heal that when you think about it? That's it.
Well, I'm very honest with him. So when I have all kinds of wacky beliefs about who I am, what I'm capable of, and where I fit into the world and what's safe and what's not. And when I'll tell him, like, I'll be like, you know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking, blah, 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 you know, about this situation, like about my new community. Oh, I'm thinking that this is a total failure. Like, I'm thinking I'm totally screwing up. This was a waste of a lot of money starting this up. I think I'm really screwing it up. And he'll just be like, do you have any factual evidence to support this?
That's awesome.
You know, like, and that's because that's how he thinks.
Right.
And I'll tell him like what evidence I think is evidence, you know, I'll give it to him. And then he'll say, yeah, he'll be like, I think you're overthinking this a little bit. And I think you're falling into your, I call it the thought vortex, but he'll say, I think you're falling into your,
I like that
thought your vortex. Patterns, Liz, like he's very, you know, good about that stuff. Yeah, that's how he responds. Like, he'll just be like, no, I think you're doing that thing that you do again. That's
yeah. It. Well, if you grow up with somebody who's invalidating and criticizing, right, you're going to question that. That's an imprint. And so to have somebody who can be the opposite of that is, and just be like, no, you're amazing. And there isn't actually any evidence for your insecurities.
Kind of. And he'll say that kind of stuff. Like, I don't know where you're coming up with this exactly, but you're kind of wrong.
But my husband does the same with me. It's good.
Yeah. It's really interesting. And I will tell you that when I first was dating him and in a relationship with him, I had a really hard time trusting it too, because he was so nice to me. Like he was so nice to me that I was like,
what are you trying to get at?
Okay. So that's really interesting. I don't know how I found him, but I knew, I don't know. I guess I knew.
Yeah. I think we know more about what we need than we give ourselves credit for. And it sounds like you knew what you needed on a level, and he has provided kind of a corrective experience for you, which is, I think in an intimate relationship like that can be the biggest healer, even outside of a therapeutic relationship, because you're with this person more often. They know you in your day-to-day, you know, intimately. So that's really cool. I'm glad you have him.
Well, none of the stuff that I do now would have ever happened without him telling me to do it. Do you know what I mean?
Like
if I had stayed in the same patterns I was always in, I guess I'd be at like a ninth grade English teacher, you know, like I'd just be doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He promotes the growth. That's beautiful.
He does, in a really interesting way. Like, because he's, like I said, he's not smothering, but he's he's different. That ding, ding, ding. Or I hope there's not an emergency. No. It's people in my community messaging. I get a notification every time someone posts something. So that's what that is. I can delete it, hopefully. So all this knowledge, which I'm a science geek. So I find all of this really, really interesting. So if we're going to apply it to things like executive function issues, because we talk about executive functions in my group in one form or another, we talk about it, that all the time.
Right.
And, well, first of all, tell me again, how does trauma affect executive functioning in general?
So, in general, I mean, it reduces executive functioning in kind of similar ways of, in ADHD. I mean, there's lack of an ability to rationalize, lack of an ability to kind of regulate emotions. I mean, it's very similar. how one sees themselves, how they're perceiving the world. It's,
if you put together a trauma and you have the wiring of a person with ADHD, it's no wonder
that
somebody would struggle with, you know, maybe maintaining meaningful work in their life.
Exactly. Exactly. Maintaining meaningful work, knowing how to, you know,
Can you imagine a job interview?
What's that?
Can you imagine a job interview?
No, it'd be so stressful. It'd be so overwhelming, and you'd feel, and here's the thing with, like, sometimes what I see with ADHD and then with trauma too, is like, there's this externalization and an internalization happening. And it's typically when you're under stress, you're perceiving threat. So you're at a job interview, you're perceiving threat, right? So your executive functioning, your frontal lobe starts, you know, not functioning in a way that's going to work in support of you at a job interview. And so you're going to be possibly all over the place, not following through with your thoughts, not being able to pick up on the most relevant information because your brain's telling you to look somewhere else because it's trying to, it's looking for threat, right? It's looking for threat all the time. And the ADHD mind, and like, I think of PTSD, and I don't know how solved this is in research, but just the way I conceptualize in my mind sometimes is like the PTSD mind, you're looking for threat, you're hypervigilant all the time. In ADHD, you're hypervigilant, you're looking for stimulation all the time. So there's kind of, you put those two together and it's a lot, it's overwhelming. And so you're in a lot of people I've noticed, like, you internalize it. It's, you look at the outside world and you see it for something it's not. And then you internalize it and think that you're horrible and you're bad and that you're inadequate. And that's that sucks. That sucks to be in that position, to feel that way. Yeah.
And I also notice it, I mean, with the people I work with, I notice it a lot in social impairment.
Yeah.
Just misreading cues. And there are times when we can joke about it. Like there are times when it can be funny. I mean, we can make jokes about it, but then there are other times when, I mean, I've had group situations where somebody really misreads something.
Yeah.
And usually it doesn't happen to me. Like, I've never had anyone get mad at me, but I've had members of my groups get mad at each other.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I can feel it happening and I'm trying to figure out where it's coming from and I'm watching and I can usually figure out where it started, but there is this problem with misreading, with ADHD and probably even more so with PTSD, with misreading the cues.
Definitely.
From other people, even the pauses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm not sure how a person could navigate. I mean, life is full of other humans.
Yes.
That is.
Yeah. That is, everywhere.
Everywhere. Yeah. Yeah. And we can't stay in our houses all night.
Right. And it's overwhelming. I think there's a lot, and I'm grateful for what you do in bringing awareness into the community around ADHD and making it more accessible for people. Because I also think the more just everyone, people even without ADHD can have knowledge, information about ADHD and how it shows up socially, there can be more compassion and more capacity to meet each other. And for somebody who's, especially somebody who's dealing with ADHD, has a history of trauma, which I find very often, if someone can meet them with more compassion, they may not react as extremely or want to isolate as extremely, right? But most people just don't, there's a lot of ignorance around ADHD and social interactions. There just is, unless you have it or love somebody who has it. And
because it's like a punchline at parties.
Yeah.
It's an ADHD thing. Like, people really try to make light of it a lot. And like I said, in some contexts, that's okay. Like, we can laugh about it. There are things that are funny, but there are other times when you're not sure. Like, you can never, with ADHD, you never know if somebody really gets it or not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's hard to size that up.
Yes, definitely. And so it makes sense why you'd react in a kind of fight or flight response to that, right? Because you're trying, like, okay, wait, did I say that joke right? Or are they taking it the right way? And your intentions are well, but it's like, how is it coming out? Is it being perceived in the way that you want it to be? Like, it's, I mean, that alone creates a lot of stress. And I mean, that's what leads to a lot of depression, I find, in ADHD. And like you said, social anxiety.
I just think, sort of like James talks about in this book, and I really feel like everybody with ADHD at some point should read this. I don't know what he considers. I know he's a therapist. I don't know what he considers himself to be, a specialist.
I think he's an ADHD specialist.
Yeah. I mean, his clinic is basically for ADHD, but I don't know. Oh, he's an LPC. Okay.
Okay. So I national counselor.
Yeah. But he has a really nice way of describing the sort of underlying constant emotional distress that we all have. I just think that when you add a trauma history onto it, it sort of like Olivardia says about depression and ADHD, I feel like it just, one makes the other one worse.
Totally. It amplifies it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All of the executive function issues you might be having with ADHD, and then you have a trauma history, it's, I don't even know, you can't say one is worse than the other. I don't even know which one you should treat, like which one you should really focus your energies on. I think Olivardia always says whichever one is more impairing.
Yes, which is totally, one is more impairing. And being able to distinguish which one is more impairing can be, I mean, really problematic. And I'm a clinician in the field, and I don't see it being done adequately. Like, I don't, it's sad. I wish I could say that more people had a better understanding of ADHD and PTSD and how to really assess for each in order to kind of distinguish that, you know, but, cause I think whichever one is impairing most, but it is really hard to tell.
Well, and from what I'm hearing, well, even Barclay in his keynote was talking about the actual larger health consequences of ADHD, untreated ADHD over the lifespan.
Yeah.
One of the things he was saying, and I've heard it in multiple places since then, is that a lot of people are diagnosed with depression first. So you might be more likely to get a PTSD diagnosis before they even look at ADHD.
Yes.
So I think in general, I don't know if the vast majority of people are being diagnosed by licensed psychologists. I don't know who's doing all the testing, you know.
That's the thing. Is like, so I am an associate marriage family therapist. And so I talk to mostly marriage family therapists, but also psychologists. But I think a lot of the diagnosing happens at the psychiatric level and then gets trickled down. So because a lot of the time we refer out to go get tested, or you call your insurance, they send you to a psychiatrist who just asks you usually a variety of questions, looks at you and decides based off of their experience, whatever their lens is, what diagnosis you have. And with ADHD, there are specific tests, you know, that can be done, but yeah, getting to that point where someone's going to say, okay, let's do a whole bunch of ADHD tests, especially if you haven't, you didn't have problems as a child, or if you compensated for your ADHD when you were a child. So like a lot of women that have adults that have ADHD that I know compensated, like they did okay in school. Like they socially just kind of kept themselves, right? Cause they were just kind of groomed in this way and they were more inattentive. And they just figured it out and then come to find out, oh wow, I've been suffering with ADHD my whole life, but I wasn't diagnosed as a kid. So you go to a psychiatrist, like I say, okay, did you have problems in school as a kid? Were you disruptive? Did you get bad grades? And if they say, well, no, okay, then ADHD is going to be taken off the table usually.
What we probably need to do is expand the, I don't want to say the criteria, but there needs to be more awareness, even with psychiatrists, maybe licensed psychologists, that maybe there are certain things they should be looking at instead of jumping straight to like, I don't know what they jump to. They seem really, really comfortable with, you know, depression.
Well, yeah, that's true. Cause it is the most obvious, I mean, depression, anxiety, are kind of the most obvious presentation sometimes, you know, so, but it's just, it's hard. And it's hard for the you know, normal person out there to really get solid answers. That's why I've just seen so many people over the course of like, you know, a decade have to go to different psychiatrists. It's like Russian roulette with medication. It's, it's a lot for one person to handle. And if you have ADHD, you're not going to want to handle all that. You're not going to want to go to your doctor's appointments and go, you know, make sure your assessment done and that you get hooked up with a therapist who really knows their stuff. I mean, that's a lot of work to figure it all out, you know?
I get annoyed. I have to go every 3 months because I take Concerta, which is still, you know, what, schedule one.
Right.
So I have to go every 3 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
I get annoyed, but I have to. And I think we do develop compensatory strategies, and some of those strategies end up being over controlling and like hyper vigilant, I think, sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes off very much as like an OCD anxiety cluster of of things.
Yes.
And I think that they just stop at the, sometimes clinicians will just stop at depression, anxiety. They'll just stop there.
Yeah. Well, it's also easier to get insurance money that way than to go deeper. I mean, honestly, there's a whole political landscape behind all this as well. You know, it's easier to give a depression diagnosis than to go through the whole thing of getting diagnosed with ADHD, being able to get okayed for the medication, the doctors now having to like, there's just a lot of stuff that they then have to regulate, which is a lot of work for physicians. And then also on top of that, it's the training that whoever you go to has. I think that's so important for people to know, to really research who they're seeing and what kind of background they come from and what kind of knowledge that they have. Cause if you just go to a general psychiatrist, you know, they may have, they all know general psychiatry, but they may have like their own little personal, you know, interest in, I don't know, learning disorder or something. So they're going to see everything through that lens. Same thing with a therapist. You go to a therapist, you can kind of see on their website, what are they into? Like, you know, and some of them will be really more into cognitive behavioral therapy and we'll look at everything through a behavioral modification approach versus, you know, an attachment or relational approach. Like there's so many different ways that people get trained. So I think it's finding the right person for you and being informed enough to know what you need. And that's hard to do when you're trying to figure that out by yourself.
Well, and ADHDers, to persevere, to push through and do that kind of work. Like, do I like this doctor? Do I even feel like he understands me? Do I, you know,
totally.
That is not our strong suit.
Totally. Yeah. And so how do you get support to get the assistance that you deserve and that you need, right? And that supports quality of life in the best way possible.
And I also think part of the issue right now, and this is just my little soapbox, is people get entirely too much of their information from social media.
True.
And yeah. Even though I found you on social media,
right. Some people are informed, some aren't.
I think that's the default, though. Like, if you have hit a wall and you're just not sure what to do, and you didn't love the last doctor you had, and your medication ran out, and you don't know what the next steps are. Oh, you know, Instagram, Facebook.
Yeah. And, like, see what other people are doing, right? Mm-hmm.
And that's just a mess, which is what Terry and I are trying to do with this enclave thing. We're trying to create a sort of off social media support group, but we want to bring in the experts too, so that there's really good, high quality information, but love still it. A community vibe.
Mm-hmm. No, that's needed. So needed.
And sometimes you have to wait months to see a doctor.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I waited 8 months to see a psychiatrist and 10 to see one for my son.
That is horrible. I think that's, oh my gosh, that's, you know, but yeah, that's how it is.
Yeah. And I feel like if people in the know, if we're talking about this and we're putting it out there, I think more people should come to the conferences. I know that's like, it's sort of an investment. It can be expensive to come to, even for one day, to come to a conference. And I'm hoping going forward in the next so many years that not every single presentation will be geared toward educating coaches. Like right now, the conference is very much, there are a lot of doctors and clinicians. And then there's like a whole, I feel like a lot of it has been about coaching, which is fine for the coaches that are interested in learning more about coaching, but for the average person to show up and just learn something or feel like they're part of something bigger, I'm hoping.
I hope for that too. I think that's just important because it's a small percentage of people who are actually the helpers in the field. The bigger percentage is all the people out there that are suffering from these symptoms and that want information and want to learn how to, you know, live a life that's it's just whole and supportive of them. And so I think that percentage of people is much bigger than the number of physicians and clinicians out there. So I think I just think it's really admirable that you're doing that. And I think it's neat.
Huge separation, right? Like professional types, clinicians and doctors, and I'll lump the coaches in up there too. And then there's like the people with the diagnosis, and it's there needs to be something in the middle, some point for people to,
I agree,
you know, and it can't always be Instagram. or Reddit,
or what are the No, I totally understand. That's why I started the resource website. Cause I went and wanted to understand PTSD and ADHD. So I went and got a master's degree, right? And I studied it clinically because there wasn't enough information out there for me. I didn't understand it. I didn't know how to look for it. I didn't know where it was. Right. And I think that more people need access to that.
And there's a need for it because I don't even have a huge audience, right? Like my friend, Terry Matlin, you know, famous Terry Matlin, she has a huge audience.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine within her audience. She has a giant Facebook group too. I can't even imagine how many people in her audience are living with trauma and ADHD. If I know that in my little circle of my little corner of the internet, I get them, then it must be much, a much bigger issue than we are currently aware of.
I agree. I don't think it's, I totally agree. I see it all the time. And I may be biased because I have so much research knowledge on both sides that I tend to see, maybe I see it more than some of my other colleagues, but I think it's there and it needs to be looked at a little bit more.
I don't know. I think I'm going to bring my like layperson touch to the conference if at all possible.
It's amazing. That's amazing.
I have goals, big goals.
I love it. I support them.
But yeah, well, thank you for doing this with me today. Yeah. How can people find you?
So people can find me through the website, through www.ptsd-adhd.com, and just shoot me an email. I think my phone number is there as well. I'm also by email, Allison@ptsd.adhd.com. I'm also based and in private practice in Long Beach, California. So if you Google search me, you can pretty much find me there too. I can give you my info, my
I'll link to you in everything.
I don't have a personal website up yet. I'm like working. It's just, yeah. Yeah. My Instagram account. I love my Instagram account. I mean, it's been, I'm like, oh, I'm just going to do it for fun because this is all the stuff that I love. And I wanted to feed my soul and my mind with the things I love and share it with the world. And it ended up kind of blowing up overnight. Like people were super interested in it too. So I just love it. And that's at PTSD_ADHD. And so that's where you'll find my, you know, whatever I'm thinking about that day, or if a client comes to me and has an issue, some solution I'm looking at for them or for myself, I pull things together when I see them and when I can, and try to create community like you around stuff that I find fascinating.
Or maybe actually there needs to be a whole like podcast episode on where to get information. Like real.
I think so. I agree. I think that should be your next podcast. I think it's really good. That's why I have on my website, I have a whole, I should add to it, but resources area of just like the main, like Chad website, like all these, the ones that are reputable, right?
Yeah.
The reputable resources people can go for information.
One of the hardest things to do for someone like you or me, or Dania, Shabib, one of the hardest things to do is to take this sort of information. You know, we like the science of it, you know,
right.
But to make it understandable and actionable for people, that's one of the hardest things with ADHD too. Like just mm-hmm. to take the research and the current information and to make it relevant to people's lives. And I think there are, I think it's growing. I think it's going to happen. And I told them that at Chad.
Love it.
I did. I'm like, listen, this is what I do. I took stuff, like all of your doctors that come to your conference, like I take the stuff and I make it understandable and a little fun for people.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping they're not offended by me saying that. All my issues are on full display.
Yeah. It's awesome though. It's relatable. That's good. I'm trying to think. I don't think there's anything. I don't know. I kind of came into it like, oh, we'll just see what happens. And this was really fun. It was cool to talk about stuff. Okay. Hopefully it was okay. And I did all right. And thanks for having me.
I didn't have a structure in mind, so it was perfect.
Okay, great.
Oh my gosh, was this not the most interesting? I mean, after Dania Shabib, I didn't think I could top it. I don't think I topped it, but this conversation with Allison was so cool. I think you'll agree. you know, the implication of a diagnosis of PTSD and ADHD, it's kind of a big deal. And there are so many of us living with these issues, and trauma isn't always what we think of as trauma. I will link to some books in the show notes because, you know, I'm super professional, sort of, or trying to be professional. I hope that you enjoyed this conversation. I know it's a long one. These long form ones, you know, they might not be really ADHD friendly, but the topics are so important. So stick around. There's so many amazing guests coming in the future. Leave me comments and reviews on iTunes. And like I always say, we are stronger together.